What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeffrey Sussman, author of the new book, Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resistors, and Avengers. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's a new secular year. Happy Sylvester, as they say in Israel, which only makes sense if you've lived in Israel or know a lot of Israelis. That's what they say instead of Happy New Year. Happy Sylvester, since the Jewish New Year was back in September at Rosh Hashanah, not now in January. In fact, there are a number of New Years in Jewish tradition. Rosh Hashanah's most familiar, of course, and the famous Mishnah at the beginning of that tractate teaches us that it is the new year for counting years, and that is Rosh Hashanah, and for calculating sabbatical and jubilee years. Rosh Hashanah is also, of course, the new year for the soul, the day of judgment, Yom HaDin, when we take account of our actions and seek to repent our sins and return to goodness and holiness. The appropriate time for New Year's resolutions for Jews, therefore, is Rosh Hashanah, not January 1st. The other New Years delineated in traditional sources include the beginning of the springtime month of Nisan. Comes in late March or early April, Passover's month. That was the New Year for governmental affairs in ancient times and the New Year for holidays. That made Pesach, the springtime freedom festival, the very first holiday of the year, idiosyncratically, not Rosh Hashanah. Oh, and then there's Tu B'Shvat, the new year for trees. That's coming up January 16th, 2 weeks from tonight and tomorrow, by the way, when they believe that sap began to flow in the trees in midwinter, kind of environmentally conscious new year. Finally, there was a tax new year, our ancestors' version of April 15th, which occurred about a month before Rosh Hashanah. Four Jewish New Years. That's not counting later New Years that could be tallied too, like Simchat Torah, the New Year for Torah, when we begin reading the Torah all over again at the end of the fall holiday cycle in late September or October. Four New Years may impress you as about three too many. So what were Jews to do with yet another New Year at the end of December and going into January? Well, in Israel, they just called it Sylvester, a semi-holiday reflecting the ambivalence of Jewish culture to adopt yet another New Year's festival. Actually, Israelis calling New Year's Eve and day Sylvester is more than a little bit bizarre. The name Sylvester doesn't come from the cartoon cat paired with Tweety Bird, but rather from the name of the saint and Roman pope who reigned during the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 CE. While that's obscure enough, there's a very dark side to this Sylvester. The year before the Council of Nicaea, in 324 CE, Sylvester convinced Roman Emperor Constantine to prohibit Jews from ever living in Jerusalem. Then at the Council of Nicaea, Sylvester also thoughtfully arranged for the passage of a host of viciously anti-Semitic legislation that was later incorporated into nearly every anti-Jewish legal code in the Byzantine Empire and, well, throughout all of Western civilization. So why do Israeli Jews celebrate a day dedicated to a vicious anti-Semite who did serious and enduring damage to our people some 1,700 years ago? Well, it's like this. Since all Catholic saints are awarded a day on which Christians celebrate and pay tribute to the saint's memory, December 31st turns out to be Saint Sylvester Day, and celebrations on the night of December 31st would technically be dedicated to Sylvester's memory. Well, it's not a guy you'd think we Jews would ever celebrate, now is it? In any case, the way Americans celebrate New Year's is also not so Jewish. Champagne, too much alcohol overall, odd snacks and bits of food, firecrackers and an old Scottish song, followed the next morning by parades and football games. These do not seem to capture the essential Jewish message of human perfectibility and the need to try to improve the world, now do they? Well, to play us in this morning, here's a song prepared for one of those Jewish New Years by Jewish communities around the world. It was called The Song for the New Year. It's dedicated to waking us up to the potential for positive change at any time of year.
How does the New Year call you? What gives you pride and regret?
Do you hear that? This is how we reset.
Whoa!
That was Jewish communities around the world singing for the new year, which we hope reflects on a better 2022 for all of us, whether or not we think it's the right time to celebrate. When we return on Too Jewish in a moment, our guest, Jeffrey Sussman, author of Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resisters, and Avengers, will explain what motivated him to write about these fascinating Jews, tough Jews, and others who fought professionally and fought back against the Nazis. Find out who they were when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol. The soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or on Facebook Live by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely, but in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. In fact, this Friday night, we have a wonderful Shabbat dinner at 5 o'clock. Delicious food and then a great oneg after. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and or Saturday morning by going to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or just coming. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening musical celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning Torah study at 9 a.m., and services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. And our services with full music will continue Friday night and Saturday morning. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs are available in person and in blended format, some students live and some on Zoom. And coming up on January 16th, 2 weeks from today, our TV to Torah celebration with Rabbi Baruch Kohan, telling his wonderful story about moving from producing and writing TV series and movies to becoming a full-time rabbi and cantor, 95-year-old guy who's just delightful. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our TV to Torah event on January 16th, Sunday, January 16th, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich and wonderful array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation and community in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Jeffrey Sussman is an author and the author of the newest book, Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resistors, and Avengers. Really interesting book. Good morning and welcome to 2Jewish.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to start with a difficult question. The stereotype is that Jews went supinely to their deaths during the Shoah, like sheep to the slaughter. That's not exactly the case. Could you clarify that a little bit?
It certainly isn't the case. And there was a group called the Avengers, Nakam in Hebrew, led by Abba Kovner, who had issued a message to the Jews of Vilna, saying that we should not go like sheep to the slaughter, and he used that as a rallying cry to organize this group of Avengers that fought very ferociously and courageously against the Nazis throughout World War II, and then after World War II, sought out a number of Nazi war criminals and executed them.
You know, Kovner becomes out as a fascinating figure, but that's actually late in the book in a way. You start out by talking about Jewish boxers. Tell us about a couple of them.
Well, the first one I wrote about was a man named Victor Young Perez, who was a young Jew from Tunis, who learned to box in a Maccabee club in Tunis along with his brother, and then came to Paris because he thought that's where his fortune and future lay. And he became the youngest flyweight French boxing champion and then the youngest European flyweight boxing champion. And he was very charismatic. He had an affair with a famous French movie actress, and they were photographed in nightclubs and restaurants, shopping on the Champs-Élysées. And he was brilliant. Unfortunately, his mistress, the French movie actress, her name was Mireille Balin. She, after the Nazis conquered France, she realized that her future lay with the Nazis, and being an opportunistic actress, she abandoned Victor Perez and went off with a Nazi SS officer. But that wasn't the worst of it. The worst of it was that she betrayed a Victor to the Nazis, and he was subsequently arrested and sent to Auschwitz, and then to an Auschwitz subcamp called Monowitz, where he was forced to fight numerous times, every week, as a matter of fact, just to keep himself alive. And he did this on a nearly starvation diet. And during the famous death march out of Auschwitz, when the Nazis were losing the war and they wanted to bring the inmates back to Germany to work in various industrial plants, on that march, Victor Perez saw a loaf of bread on the side of the road that was stale and perhaps even a little moldy, and he ran off to get it to feed himself and a number of his colleagues. And an SS officer saw him and ran up behind him and shot him twice in the head. And he was a young man when this happened. He was just one of five boxers that I profiled in my book, four Jews and one Sintai, which is a division of gypsies.
There are many fascinating stories in your book. We will talk much more with our guest this morning, Jeffrey Sussman, about his book, Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resisters, and Avengers, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from twojewishradio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, as very popular podcast, or from Podbean. We are top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona. Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And a happy secular new year.
And to you.
We started talking last week about Jewish sectarian movements, which is a really important factor in the development, not only of Judaism, but of Christianity, of kind of all of Western civilization. We got almost up to the first century. We didn't quite make it there last time. A time when the Pharisees and the Sadducees are the two principal, or at least the most important sects that survive, and they're portrayed, well, in very interesting ways, historically speaking. Maybe we can start talking about that a little
bit. Okay, so we'll move forward. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, this dichotomy existed really in the first century of the Common Era. We were talking about the second century before the Common Era.
Right.
The we should talk about what came
so
between.
That's a good idea.
And we should also say, I mean, lest all this stuff seem like ancient history and irrelevant, it was not so long ago that various Hasidic sects were essentially at war with each other, throwing stones verbally or physically.
We still see conflicts at the Kotel, for example, in which not only did Hasidic sects fight amongst themselves, but we see ultra-Orthodox Jews attacking non-Orthodox Jews because women are praying with a Torah scroll, right, things like that.
So sectarianism is essentially a problem that lives on, but took different forms at different times. So we were talking about the Greek period and the Maccabees and the Hanukkah that we celebrated 6 weeks ago or whatever. What happened next? Well, what happened next was the Romans came and displaced the Greeks gradually. But of course, in the eastern reaches of the Roman Empire in particular, and even in Italy itself, Greek remained the language of intellectual expression and creativity, and a lot of Greek culture survived, particularly in the portion of the Roman Empire that became the Byzantine Empire, which includes Israel.
Right. Well, in fact, I mean, it was used for official documents and stuff.
Right.
You know.
So the attitudes of Jews towards Greeks and Greek culture still mattered after the Romans took over. And in the first century before the Common Era, there were even more divisions among sects. There were people who wanted to launch like guerrilla-like movements from the countryside to purify the cities from the evil cosmopolitan urbanites. And there were the Essenes and the Zealots, and there were all kinds of groups. The ones that seemed to play a major role in early Christian history and certainly appear in the Old Testament are the two that you mentioned, which you probably know much more about than I do. So I'd like you to talk about who exactly were
the Pharisees
and the Sadducees.
Sure. So easiest way to talk about it is start with the Sadducees, because they were by and large the aristocratic class of the Jews. They included the Maccabees, by and large, the Hasmonean Greeks, the Hasmonean Jews, and they were the people who were more ritually oriented. The temple was the center of their ritual life. Now it was the center of everybody's ritual life, but they were much more focused on laws of purity and the priesthood and the specific rituals, and they were much less interested in, if you will, the moral and legal structure that came not specifically out of the Torah, but all the laws that built up around the Torah and later became the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Pharisees were by and large the artisan class, the working class, middle class, and farmers and lower class. And they were people who were less likely to be so focused on ritual and more interested in how does the Torah apply to our lives and how do we make it in a practical way, something that we can live every day. And that was a theoretical difference that literally became almost a kind of class warfare at times, in which they really went very different directions in how they saw Judaism moving forward in the first century.
All right. Well, thanks for that explanation, because it underscores the degree to which early Christian depictions of Pharisees and Sadducees are counterfactual. They're not only groundless, they're
the opposite of what actually took place.
Right.
And we'll take that up next time. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe is eating lunch at the deli one day. He notices a very elderly couple at the next table. They have one plate with a corned beef sandwich and potato salad, one cream soda, and an empty glass. The old man carefully divides the corned beef sandwich in half, then separates the potato salad into little piles, pours the drink into the empty glass in front of his wife, well, half the drink, and then begins to eat while his wife just watches, her hands folded in her lap. Abe is saddened and concerned. He solicitously offers to buy them another corned beef so they don't have to split theirs. But the old man explains, "Oh no, very kind but unnecessary. We've been married 60 years and we share everything 50-50, always." So Abe asks the old lady, "So why aren't you eating?" And she answers, "It's his turn with the teeth." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and, you know, share the teeth. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bo features the actual Exodus from Egypt. The climactic text is familiar from Passover seders and movies, but it is no less dramatic. Moses and Aaron warn Pharaoh a final plague is coming. God tells the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb, put its blood on their doorposts to protect themselves from the coming calamity. At midnight, the angel of death visits the homes of every Egyptian, from the Pharaoh on his throne to the prisoner in the dungeon, and the firstborn male son of every household dies. Even the livestock lose their firstborn. After long refusing freedom to the Israelites, after 10 plagues and every underhanded manipulation he could invent, finally Pharaoh gives up. He literally throws the Israelites out of Egypt, saying, "Go away from my people." There's an ironic twist at the end of this freedom narrative in Bo. Even before the Pharaoh's fruitless quest to recapture the Israelites at the sea ends badly for the Egyptians, in next week's portion of Bishalach, Pharaoh has already ordered Moses and Aaron to leave his land, but before they go, he says, "Be gone, but bless me first." This is a strange thing to say to an enemy, to whom you are now essentially surrendering. Get out now, but before you go, give me a blessing. There is pathos in this request, for Pharaoh has been an arrogant and magnificently stubborn opponent. Moses' request was for religious freedom for the Israelite slaves, 3 days to worship God in their own Hebrew fashion. Rejecting this simple plea, Pharaoh instead multiplied the slaves' work, reduced their supplies, increased their misery in the time-honored tradition of every union-busting tyrant in history. This combination of arrogance and egotism has now brought death to his country and his family. Pharaoh's own eldest son, his designated successor, has just died. And now he says to his antagonists, Moses and Aaron, bless me too? Interestingly, the Torah does not record Moses' response to this strange request. Did he offer a prayer for Pharaoh? What's the suitable blessing for a brutal, genocidal, dictatorial, fascistic god-king? Was it a mourning prayer for the Pharaoh's dead son? Or was it more like that rabbi and fiddler on the roof? May God bless and keep the Pharaoh far away from us. After 9 plagues worth of direct evidence, the overwhelming power of Moses' God has become clear, even to this human representative of Egypt's polytheistic gods, a man who may even believe himself to be divine. And in that surrender, a little bit of humanity from Pharaoh peeks through. My gods are discredited. My blessings and curses overthrown. In my mourning, in my confusion, in my despair, I need blessing from my worst enemy. Something peculiarly human about this, just as true today as over 3,000 years ago. Often in life we seek blessing not from those who support us and agree with us, but from those who don't. We long for the respect, if not the love, of those who are hardest to please and least likely to accept us. Sometimes, the approval or admiration of our enemies ranks higher in our own estimation than the steady praise of our acolytes. As Jews, we know this odd motivation. How often do we struggle with the need for approval from figures who do not give it easily, with the lack of unconditional parental love, the absence of regard from those from whom we most need it, the near desperate desire to be accepted? It's not to say Pharaoh is a needy Jewish child or Moses an uncaring Jewish parent. The Pharaoh of this story is an evil megalomaniac tyrant. But apparently megalomaniac tyrants have emotional needs too. Even in a warped person, the human need for parental approval remains. In a story filled with drama and power, the plaintive request, bless me too, adds a human note. We all need divine blessing. Pharaoh never does. He soon regrets his emotional weakening in Bo, chases after the Israelites to further his own ruin. But perhaps we, who have done so much less wrong than Pharaoh, and who need blessing at least as much, perhaps we will be able to find it in our own lives. When we return, our guest, Jeffrey Sussman, introduces us to some fascinating Jewish boxers who survived the Holocaust, some who didn't, and tells us why Max Schmeling could be a hero for Jews. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Chaim Walder, an Israeli Haredi ultra-Orthodox children's book author who was accused last month of sexual abuse by several teenage girls, was found dead last week in an apparent suicide. His body was located in a cemetery in Petah Tikva in central Israel after a passerby heard a gunshot and called the police. Walder's death came a day after a rabbinical court in Sfat heard testimony from 22 young women about alleged abuse at Walder's hands. The abuse dated back as far as 25 years ago and as recently as just 6 months ago, which shook up the Orthodox world when the Israeli newspaper Haaretz first revealed a smaller set of allegations against Walder last month. Walder, who was 53, had a wildly successful career as a columnist, radio host, teacher, public speaker, and most notably author of the successful children's book series Kids Speak. In addition to his writing, Walder also worked as a therapist and was honored in 2003 with the Israeli Prime Minister's Protector of the Child Award. Several women accused him of initiating sexual relationships with them when they approached him for counseling. The accounts of alleged abuse led to an unusually strong reaction within the Haredi Orthodox community, which tends to sweep accusations of bad behavior under the rug rather than publicly oust abusers. After a New York Jewish bookstore, Eichler's, announced it would no longer sell Walder's books, which had been required reading in many Orthodox homes, a flood of consequences followed. Walder's longtime publisher, Feldheim Publishers of New York, tweeted it would remove Walder's books from shelves while the allegations against him were being investigated. Yatid Ne'eman and Radio Kol Chai, two Israeli news organizations, suspended Walder from his positions at the companies in the wake of the allegations. Several prominent rabbinic leaders urged parents to remove his books from their homes. And the Beit Din, the rabbinical court, was holding hearings, which Walder reportedly declined to participate in. It is too bad he chose this path. We offered him the option to fix what he had broken, to apologize to his victims, to change his ways, to ensure no more women would be harmed, said the head of that court, Sfat Chief Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu. We send strength to the many victims in these difficult times. Their lives precede his life. Even as some parts of the Haredi ultra-Orthodox world moved to excise Walder and his books from their lives, some ignored the allegations. In reporting Walder's death, B'chadrei Charidim, an Israeli Orthodox news site, made no mention of the allegations against Walder and concluded the article with, "May his memory be a blessing." Advocates for victims of sexual abuse in the ultra-Orthodox world said they were heartened by the unusual reaction and hoped it would become the norm with future allegations. "There's no easier right way to process news like this," the group Zaka said. "While some may consider his death a relief, many others, including his numerous victims, see it as a denial of justice." In other news, the first ever official gathering of rabbis from Jewish communities in Islamic countries convened in Istanbul last week for the inaugural conference of the Alliance of Rabbis in Islamic States, ARIS. Much to their surprise, they were invited to fly on a private plane to Ankara for what turned into a two-hour meeting and dinner with Turkish dictator, president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which was described as very cordial and productive. Rabbi Mendi Çitrik, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Turkey and director of ARIS, only got the news that the Turkish president would receive the rabbis of the alliance hours before the conference was going to begin. According to Çitrik, Erdogan stayed with them for 2 hours discussing a variety of topics. The president listened very gracefully to all the rabbis. He has spoken in very strong terms against anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and reiterated the Turkish stance that denying the Holocaust is a crime against humanity, Çitrik said, adding that Erdogan also voiced his support for the construction and renovation of synagogues in Turkey and in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. Another topic addressed was the state of Turkish-Israeli relations, which aren't so good. "I value our renewed dialogue with Israeli President Isaac Herzog and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett," Erdogan noted to the rabbis. The surprise, indeed shock, comes from the fact that Turkey had very close ties to Israel up to about 12 years ago, but the dramatic erosion of that relationship has a lot to do with Erdogan. Erdogan has called Israel a terrorist state and accused it of genocide. Despite continuing trade relations with Israel, the Turkish government also hosts the leadership of Hamas on its soil and is a major funder of Palestinian causes in Gaza and the West Bank. The Turkish president reiterated that position but called on the rabbis to be part of the solution. "We all have to strive for peace in the Middle East," Erdogan said. "We do not want to see any conflicts in this geography that is home to three Abrahamic religions." In May 2021, Erdogan was castigated by U.S. President Joe Biden for statements trading on anti-Semitic tropes that the Turkish president made during Israel's flare-up of tensions with Gaza last year. "They are murderers," he said, "to the point that they kill children who are 5 or 6 years old. They only are satisfied by sucking their blood," Erdogan said at the time. "It is in their nature." One can only hope that Erdogan treats Turkish Jews and visiting Israelis better than he treats Turkish journalists, who are routinely rounded up, tortured, and imprisoned for saying anything remotely critical of the president for 20 years to life, Erdogan. Still, the rabbis welcomed the meeting with him. "We are forward-looking rabbis. We are working in communities in the Muslim world. We are looking to strengthen Jewish life. There are many things in the past, but we are looking forward, working on the present and working for the future," said Çitrik. The meeting concluded with Turkey's Sephardic chief rabbi, Isaac Haleva, gifting the Turkish President Erdogan with an ornate menorah. There are about 100,000 Jews currently living in Muslim countries, including Iran, Egypt, Tunisia, Albania, Kosovo, the United Arab Emirates, Azerbaijan, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, Kazakhstan, and elsewhere. Jews have lived in Muslim nations for about, 1,300 years, and they once formed communities of over a million Jews about a century ago. In Israel, Defense Minister Benny Gantz hosted Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas last week for a working meeting at his home, discussing economic and security issues. The meeting was Abbas's first formal meeting in Israel since 2010, the second one with Gantz under the current Israeli government, after an August meeting in Ramallah. Their meeting comes a week after U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visited the region and called on Israeli officials to do more to help the situation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In addition to formal meetings, Gantz and Abbas also met in private, agreeing on a series of economic concessions that Israel will provide to the Palestinian Authority. According to an Israeli statement, Gantz agreed to grant residency rights to 6,000 people living in the West Bank who currently have no legal status, and about 3,500 in the Gaza Strip. Israel has also agreed to give the Palestinian Authority 100 million shekels, about $32 million, as an advance on the taxes that Israel collects on the Palestinian Authority's behalf. Israel will also give hundreds of permits for Palestinian business people to let them move relatively freely between the West Bank and Israel, and dozens of so-called VIP passes for senior Palestinian Authority officials. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett opposes Palestinian independence and has ruled out formal peace talks, but he has said he wants to reduce frictions with the Palestinian Authority and improve living conditions in the West Bank. Israeli President Isaac Herzog called the meeting positive, stressing that security coordination is a crucial part of the fight against terrorism. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Jeffrey Sussman is the author of the new book, Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resisters, and Avengers. How did you decide to write this book?
I had the first book about boxing I wrote was called Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing.
By the way, I have that book. I just wanted to...
Oh, wonderful.
And I really enjoyed it. Go ahead.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry.
You know, I was a skinny little Jewish kid growing up in New York, and my father thought that I should learn to box to defend myself. And he had a friend named Abe Simon, who he had gone to high school with, who became a heavyweight boxer and actually fought Joe Louis twice for the heavyweight title. He lost both times. But my father told me an interesting story that they belonged to a Jewish club, and they would have dances on Saturday night after the Sabbath. And during the Easter season, a group of Irish kids were outside chanting anti-Semitic threats. And Abe Simon, who was enormous, he was about 6'4", 6'5", and weighed 250 pounds when he was a senior in high school, and had a twin brother. They both rushed outside and beat up a few of these hooligans, and the others ran off. And I became fascinated by the idea of Jews standing up through boxing against forces of anti-Semitism. And after I had written Max Baer and Barney Ross, Jewish Heroes of Boxing, I came across information about another boxer named Harry Haft, who was also a concentration camp survivor. And I read about him, and that led me into investigating the lives of several others. And then I got to interview Harry Haft's son and the son of another boxer named Nathan Chapow. And I found their stories absolutely fascinating. And I decided then to go ahead and do additional research and write the book.
There's a terrible brutality to the experience of these guys forced to box for the entertainment of the SS or the Gestapo, whoever was watching. This is a common story, and then some of them, of course, were executed, as you noted, with Perez. Tell us a little bit about that How did that work?
Boxing was a very popular sport in Germany. That and soccer were the two most popular sports at the time. And Hitler was a big fan of boxing. He had written in Mein Kampf that he wanted all Wehrmacht soldiers to learn to box. And all the members, these little kids who had to join the Hitler Youth Movement, they also were forced to box. And there are newsreels of these little skinny kids with huge boxing clubs on, flailing away at each other. And so when these Jews who were capable of boxing were arrested and sent to Auschwitz, the Nazi guards did not want them to fight other Nazis because there was a chance that the Jews would defeat them, and that would deflate the image of the Aryan Superman.
Right.
So instead, they wanted them to fight other inmates, and they knew that the stronger Jew would probably beat the weaker Jew, and it would be for their entertainment, and it would satisfy their love of boxing, but at the same time, it would also reduce Jews to kind of an animalistic state where they regarded them not only as subhuman, but almost as feral creatures. And it was terrible for the Jews who were forced to do this, because on the one hand, they felt very guilty about the men they defeated, because they know that the men whom they defeated would either be gassed or starved to death, or shot, or beaten. On the other hand, if they rebelled against participating in these fights, they would have been killed. So it was a terrible choice that they had to make, and many of them lived with a deep sense of guilt for the rest of their lives about this. But, Nathan Schapow, getting back to your original question about not going off to die like sheep, his motto was, better to die a brave man than to be killed as a coward. And he felt that if he had to die at the hands of the Nazis, he would die fighting them.
How many of these guys survived the war?
Perez was killed, and the Sinti boxer, Johann Trollmann, was also killed in the camps.
Yeah.
Schapow and a Greek boxer named Salomo Aruch both survived. They both went to Israel, fought for Israel's independence after the war. I think it was Aruch who joined the Haganah and then the IDF, and Schapow fought with the IDF. Schapow then came to America, and Aruch stayed and lived out his life in Israel.
Tell us about Abba Kovner and the revenge that was taken. I don't know, revenge is exactly right. Justice that was done after the war.
Kovner was a fascinating a figure, very, very charismatic, a natural-born leader, and people who encountered him, they immediately followed him. And he initially, this was fascinating, he initially wanted to poison the water supply in Germany, because he wanted to kill 6 million Germans to make up for the six million Jews who were killed.
Right.
And of course, that wouldn't work. He was talked out of it. He realized it was impractical. Not only that, a lot of innocent people would have been killed, including children. So instead, he decided that they would poison a number of SS guards, war criminals, by breaking into a bakery and poisoning the bread that they would eat. Unfortunately, the poison was spread too thinly, so all these SS guards merely got sick. Very few of them died. However, he and the Avengers did go out and often disguised themselves in British uniforms or American uniforms, and went calling on Nazi war criminals who were more low level than the ones who were tried at Nuremberg, and they would say that you were wanted for questioning. We want to take you to headquarters where we're going to interrogate you. And they would get in a car, and instead of taking them to headquarters, they would drive to a wooded area. They would push them out of the car, and they would say, you've committed terrible crimes, and now it's time for justice to be given to you. And they would force the person to kneel and then shoot that person in the back of the head and kill them. And it was reported that the the Nakam killed about 1,500 Nazi war criminals after the war.
One of the truths that comes out is this image of the Nazi Superman. Obviously, none of the Nazi leaders, except maybe Heydrich, actually fit the stereotype of the Aryan Superman. None of them looked like it. None of them had physical characteristics like that. Most of them were not athletic. It's fascinating that hypocrisy that permeated the entire system and led them having to, when they found these Jewish athletes, diminish them and brutalize them. What's your biggest takeaway from this book?
Oh, that's an interesting question. My takeaway is that Jews do better when they fight against oppression, when they fight against anti-Semitism. And I wanted my book to inspire others and to show that Jews were not, as you said, supine sheep going off to be slaughtered. And that when they stand up for themselves and they fight back against anti-Semitism, 9 times out of 10, they're going to win.
Where can people go to find out more about you, Jeffrey, and to find out more about the book?
Well, the book is on Amazon.com, and there are several talks I've given at Holocaust centers that are on YouTube right now. And there's a brief bio of me on the Amazon book page for my books.
Thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Holocaust Fighters, Boxers, Resistors, and Avengers. And it's a good read and a compelling story. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Our pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs. In a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Jewish filmmaker Alana Waksman. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services at Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. We have a Shabbat dinner this Friday night at 5. Sign up on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush. And January 16th, from TV to Torah with Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, great night celebrating his journey from the television motion picture industry to full-time Judaism. To play us out this morning, here's Omer Adam's wintry hit song, Choref Be'oto. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and the beginning of a good 2022, a week, we pray, of peace.
אם את עוזבת, אז אולי לפחות נדבר. את כבר לא זוכרת איך היה לך פשוט לוותר עלינו. נתתי הכל בשבילנו, בלילה אחד זה נגמר. את הלכת ושארת לב נשבר. עוד חורף באור.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.